David Jeffrey, JMU's August Dean of the College of Arts and Letters, woke up March 29th with a mission. His beloved Harry Cruz, American novelist, playwright, short story writer, essayist, reprobate, and general wild man, had died the day before, and David was determined to do what he could to lift Mr. Cruz from undeserved obscurity. David emailed me forthwith and asked if he could come on The Spark and talk about Harry Cruz. And I said, sure, just as soon as I have a chance to read something by the man. So I dove into A Childhood, the biography of a place, which is Harry Cruz's account of his hardest of hardscrabble childhoods in rural Bacon County, Georgia. And I could hardly make myself put that book down long enough to do anything else. I began my conversation with David Jeffrey about Harry Cruz by asking which he met first, the man or his work.
Well, the work first. I was writing my dissertation on Tobias Smollett, the fifth most famous 18th century British novelist. After, Defoe, Fanny Burney, people like that. And this was in Auburn. Fellow was up there who was a friend of Cruz's, had come from. This is probably in the early to mid-70s, and Harry had three or four books out by then, three. And Pat said, you're up here writing on this not very amusing man, this very serious fellow. Not that Cruz wasn't serious, but he said, maybe you ought to read this, take a break. And so he gave me the first book, I think, The Gospel Singer, and I was fascinated by it.
What was so fascinating?
Well, there are not a lot of books about a midget with a 27-inch foot.
But a lot of people might say, why should I care about a midget with a 27-inch foot?
Well, it's also about a preacher and his inability to be faithful, his inability to carry out his Christian faith, his inability not to seduce women, his inability not to seduce women. And it's funny, but it's also violent. There's a mob scene at the end where the mob turns on the preacher after he confesses and rips him apart, lynches him, and his mom is there trying to stop it. A lot of Harry's books end in brutal mob scenes, and I asked him about that when I eventually met him, and he said, well, that was his vision of what humanity was capable of and what people are like in mobs. And
did it all seem foreign to you, or did it seem as though he was writing about some hidden core of you as a person that you don't usually think about?
Yeah. Well, I'd been in the South as a police officer in Richmond and then a couple of years in Greensboro and 3 years at Chapel Hill. But that was mostly because I ran with the wrong crowd in Greensboro, I'm afraid to say. Well, I don't mean the UNCG crowd. I mean, some of the folks that I ran with outside of the university crowd were pretty rough. And in Chapel Hill, I lived out at Eli Whitney, which was about 10 miles outside of Chapel Hill, and it was farm people. So I was fascinated, and moving down to Alabama was a whole different kind of experience. I mean, the Deep South is very different, as you probably know, from the Mid-South. When I got to Auburn in the 70s, a newspaper ran a full-page ad from the KKK with the N-word all over it, and their editorial said, these are the kind of people that want you to elect George Wallace. And we donated their money to the NAACP. So it was pretty raw in the 70s, and I was always been interested in raw.
Raw.
Yeah, in the rough South.
Where were you raised?
The Jersey Shore. Toms River and Seaside Heights were farming communities. 10,000 people, chicken farmers. You know, we were lower class.
You know, to venture a personal opinion, I feel sometimes that people who are pretty much always Southern polite are that way because there's an awful lot of human nature and human experience that they simply choose to ignore.
I think that's true. I agree. When I interviewed for the job at Auburn, we sat a couple of the faculty members who were already there and I rocking on a veranda in a grand old Southern mansion, and one of them said, "You know, they're coming for us." And he meant the people at Tuskegee. It was 1969. And he was terrified that there was going to be an invasion of African Americans from across the county line to take all of what he had away. And I went there anyway. I can't.
Back to the subject of the late Harry Cruz.
There are not a lot of tricks of style with Harry, but there is extraordinary clarity. He can place you in a person's mind and place you in a scene. And in A Feast of Snakes, for example, Joe Lon is dealing whiskey out of a shack on his property before a rattlesnake rodeo. And you can almost smell the whiskey. I mean, it's you can smell the people who come in to buy the whiskey. It's an extraordinary gift. You're not a stylist. You're not showing off. And it's not just workmanlike prose. It is vivid. You know exactly what this looks like in the childhood the same way. You can practically smell the hired help. I think he thought this is a vanished South, and it's something worth looking at. It's something worth knowing about. It's something that you're not going to ever see yourself or experience and worth preserving as a result. But it's also true to him. It's a real experience. It's his real experience, and he wants you to be able to know what it was like on the other side of your education, your class, your glasses, whatever. As I say, I'm from New Jersey. I tend to be probably more blunt than I should be most of the time. But it's difficult as you get older to change. I've always been attracted by that kind of honesty, that kind of bluntness. Harry's novels get better and better. He'd come out with one, and I'd rush out and buy it. And about the late 70s, he was really at the top of his game. Published A Gypsy's Curse and A Feast of Snakes and A Childhood in about a three-year, four-year period. And they're magnificent. And so I wrote to the Paris Review and said, "Would you like an interview with Harry Cruz?" They said, "We'd like to see an interview with Harry Cruz." I said, "Fine." So I wrote down to Harry and said, "Like to do an interview. Paris Review is interested, et cetera, et cetera." I was at Auburn. So I went down on a Saturday and figured I'd, you know, get used to the place and one thing or another. Had dinner, went to a bar. Harry just left. The man said, "So I chased Harry from bar to bar. Never did find him." So called the number, and his girlfriend answered. And Harry struggled to the phone and said, "Oh, yeah, I remember. And come on around." Gave me directions. Went to his house, her house. He said, dropped two bootleg Quaaludes and had been drinking for 3 days. So, but he talked for 6 hours. It was extraordinary. The man had a constitution of an ox. teach contemporary Southern literature. I always teach Cruz. I teach Faulkner and Welty and Flannery O'Connor. And Harry was very, very careful reader of O'Connor and loved her stuff because she starts you out in a real world you think you know. And then all of a sudden you drop off the end of the earth. You know, that's pretty much what happens in most of Cruz's books. You think you know where you are. You start out in an ordinary world and all of a sudden pop the whip into a hog scalding vat, or your legs have drawn up behind you as a result of polio, which is his experience in a childhood, in his childhood.
I want you to read something from a childhood so everybody can get a taste for what this guy's writing is like. Do you think the part where our 12-year-old hero gets God and has sex on the same evening at the same revival, do you think that's too racy?
It's your show, Martha.
You got a point. Okay, let's go for it.
Our own minister had prepared us for the evangelist, a man from Colorado who continuously traveled about the country calling down the wrath of the living God on all unsaved heads. He also called down the love, which sounded exactly like the wrath, of the living God on the same heads. Hell came right along with God, hand in hand. The stink of sulfur swirled in the air of the church, fire burned in the aisles, and brimstone rained out of the rafters. From the evangelist's oven mouth spewed images of a place with pitchforks and devils and lakes of fire that burned forever. God had fixed a place like that because he loved us so much. With a God like that on one side and a hell like that on the other, it was enough to make a little boy unaware of his loosening bowels. But even when I realized, I didn't care. What was filling my shoes compared to a God who might boil me forever? A word and a condition I could not imagine. Worse, he was going to do it for reasons of love. He had, the evangelist said, sent his only son to be beaten with brambles and given vinegar to drink, and finally even nailed to a tree for the same reasons of love. I couldn't imagine such a being, but that didn't help a bit. It gave no comfort at all, because by now the man raging up there in the pulpit owned me, every cell, blood, bone, and hair. Faith had nothing to do with it. I was one with the voice and the vision of the God-crazed evangelist, standing 6.5 feet tall in cowboy boots, joyous in his anger at my filthy life, with hands so enormous that as he buried me in the water later that night, his fingers wrapped my head as if it were an orange. When a man like that told you God, by God, was coming soon, was probably on his way this very night to touch you with his love if you didn't come on home to Jesus right now, you didn't argue about it, resist it, or even think about it. You just shit in your pants, stood up, and staggered down the aisle toward the altar, blinded by tears and terror. But I had always known I would someday have to do God. I had been watching people do him all my life, fainting, screaming, crying, and thrashing about over the floor. My turn had come, and I'd survived him. All that was left was it as it charged out into the night. I don't remember what I was thinking or if I was thinking anything, but as Bonehead kept watching for the little girl's older sister whom their mother had sent to look for her, I got a little girl down on the dark back porch of the church, delirious, full of God and raging. I didn't know when it was over, if she had given me it or not, but Bonehead and I were pretty sure she had.
David Jeffrey, English professor and JMU's Dean of the College of Arts and Letters, talking about the late Harry Cruz, glorious Southern writer and wild man. The Spark is a joint production of the WMRA Land Community and the staff of WMRA Public Radio. Rachel Quimby produced the conversation with Kathleen Meyer. Our theme music is supplied by the Avant Gardeners of Albemarle County. Terry Ward is the Spark's web wrangler. Please do send your interview suggestions to me through the Spark page at WMRA.org. I'm Martha Woodruff. It has been a great pleasure to be with you.